Love this podcast? Support this show through the supporter feature from Acast. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news ad free. That's amazon.com/news ad free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Attention, collectors of vinyl. Have you ever gone into a record store and felt overwhelmed by all the unfamiliar options? Are you frustrated by the constantly increasing prices of classic rock staples? Do you avoid streaming music or long for the days when music was recommended to you by a friend instead of an algorithm? If the answer to any of these questions is yes, then check out I'd Buy That for a Dollar, a podcast about inexpensive, common, and underappreciated records that are waiting to be rediscovered. Each week, hosts Sean, Jeremy, and Peter discuss an album and the artist's history. Previous episodes include selections by the Isley Brothers, the Carpenters, the Doobie Brothers, and Donna Summer, among others. Become a bargain bin pro and impress all your friends with cool music trivia. Listen to I'd Buy That for a Dollar wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks for listening to Creative Control. While I have you here, please consider supporting Youth Empowerment and Support Services, otherwise known as YES. Based in Edmonton, Alberta, YES provides immediate and low-barrier overnight and day shelter, temporary supportive housing, and individualized wraparound supports for young people aged 15 to 24. They work collaboratively within a network of care focused on the prevention of youth homelessness by providing youth with the necessary supports to stabilize their housing, improve their well-being, build life skills, connect with community, and avoid re-entry into homelessness. Learn more about how to donate or otherwise support YES by visiting yess.org.
Hi, I'm Jed Bodwin, and I live in Wichita, Kansas. I am a Patreon supporter for Creative Control. I discovered Creative Control some years ago, I think maybe while looking for interviews with Tommy Stinson of The Replacements. And I stumbled across this conversation that Vish had with Tommy Stinson that was really insightful. Vish held his own. I think Tommy can be a little bit of a difficult interview at times. And it went really well, and it really got into some areas that I wasn't expecting. And I thought, gosh, I have to listen to more of this guy and his podcast. Yeah, sometimes I'm not necessarily a fan of the music or musicians that Vish will have on the show, but I always appreciate their creative process a little bit more. And more times than not, though, it does lead me to finding a new musical artist that I'm interested in, or to think a little bit differently about maybe some artists whose work I've overlooked. So, you know, go ahead, and if you've been waiting at all to support Vish and Creative Control, now is probably the best time to do it. I know as a public radio employee here in Kansas, listener-supported broadcasting, whether it's podcasts or radio itself, really isn't a thing of the past. It's actually very much a thing of both the present and the future. So, yay Vish, yay Creative Control.
To make your flexible monthly donation to Creative Control, please visit patreon.com/creativecontrol today.
Creative Control with Vish Khanna.
Dana Gould is one of the most gifted comedic voices of his generation and has long lived in Los Angeles, California. Originally from Boston, where he became a stand-up star in the 1980s, Gould moved to California at the end of that decade, where he secured writing and or acting gigs on The Ben Stiller Show, Seinfeld, Roseanne, Mystery Men, and many more films and TV shows. Between 2001 and 2007, he was a writer and producer on The Simpsons, but still tended to his own stand-up and film work, and later released specials like 2017's Mr. Funny Man via Kill Rock Stars. And with Bobcat Goldthwait, he co-stars in the recent documentary / special Joyride. On Saturday, May 28th, 2022, at 6 p.m., Dana performs at the Rio Theater as part of Just for Laughs Vancouver, and this prompted us to have a nice chat about his start in comedy and why he and I have maintained a sober lifestyle, his issues with control and why he can't hang out in submarines, how comedians like George Carlin, Richard Pryor, Albert Brooks, and Steve Martin altered his life, his audition for Saturday Night Live and eventual work with the cast and crew of The Ben Stiller Show, being at peace with himself and his career, The Simpsons' evolution in response to calls to alter its voice cast to be more reflective of the cultures they represent, his current act and how the Joyride project with Bobcat Goldthwait took shape, his own podcast and pursuits, other future plans, and much more. A part of the Entertainment One Network with the support of listeners like you who follow and subscribe to this podcast and spread the word about it, and make flexible monthly donations at patreon.com/creativecontrol, plus in-kind support from Pizza Trocadero, The Bookshelf, and Planet Bean Coffee, each located in Guelph, Ontario, and Granddad's Donuts in Hamilton, Ontario. This is episode 689 of Creative Control, featuring the lovely and talented Dana Gould, with your host, me, Vish Khanna. Hi, Dana. How's it going?
Hey, Vish. How are you today?
I'm well. Thanks for joining me. Right off the top, before I get to where you are and what's going on, I need to apologize. We were meant to speak last Thursday, but I was en route to Tulsa, Oklahoma from Edmonton, Alberta, which is a 14-hour trek.
Ugh.
And I got caught in Denver, and the pilot told us before we got on the plane that he probably couldn't land in Tulsa that night on the Wednesday. And then he said, but we're going to try anyway. He described like a hellscape of climate change, weather problems, took us to Denver, circled back and said, sorry, guys, can't land. Tornadoes, crazy storms, got to take us back to Denver. So it was frustrating.
Oh. Like, yeah, you never want to hear, we're going to try it anyway.
Our lives hang in the balance.
We're going to roll the dice.
Burn a bunch of fuel, even though we know conclusively we won't be able to land this plane where we're meant to go. I thought it was odd. Anyway, as a result, you and I, I've really, really apologized. I've never stood anyone
up. Oh, that's
not
a problem at all.
Okay, I felt bad. It was out of my control. It was the weather. It was a plane. I just wanted to say it's an honor to speak with you. I'm a fan.
Oh, well, you're very kind. And I have anytime something gets delayed, I'm like, oh, good.
Okay, I appreciate that as well. So that out of the way, where in the world are you today, Dana?
I'm speaking to you from the beautiful sunny city of Los Angeles, California.
Nice. And you've been there a long time, is that fair to say?
Yeah, I moved here in 1989.
Oh, wow.
And prior to that, I lived in San Francisco for a couple of years, but I'm from Boston originally.
Right. And you talk about Boston sometimes in your act. Was Boston cool to grow up in, come up in?
Well, I only know, I don't know anything else. It's taken me a while to recover, so I'm not sure if cool is the word you'd use, but it was really interesting. It was really great. It was a great place to be a stand-up when I was doing it because there was just so much opportunity, and the supply and demand was really weighted towards supply, and I was doing it. I got so much stage time and was actually making money, like really right out of the gate. And largely because I had a car and I didn't do coke. So the other comedians on the show that were older and more established knew that I could drive to the gig and get them back and they didn't have to offer me their Coke. So I worked a lot. And the crowds were tough. You know, it's a port city. It's a working class city. And it was like boot camp. It was like Marine boot camp. Like if you came out of the Boston scene when I was there anyway, you absolutely were not afraid of any crowd.
Yeah. Now, I myself have never drank or done drugs of any kind. So I...
Oh, me neither.
Oh, well, there you go. So we're similar. Yeah. And I want to get into that a little bit because it's not... I think it's more normal now. You hear about it more. People are like, yeah, I don't do that. Or I did all that stuff and now I don't. You know, people get sober.
Yeah.
That's common. But so I was going to say I was often the designated driver as well. Because, hey, can you road manage our tour? Like bands would ask me. I'm like, oh, you heard that I don't have fun. That's why you're asking.
We heard you were a grown-up.
So yeah, I did. That's my experience too. But what do you suppose helped you avoid those trappings? Because they're very...
I don't suppose it. I know it exactly.
Yeah.
You know, my family of origin was heavily inebriated or drug influenced all the time. And it was literally, you know, both my parents drank, all of their friends drank, all of our relatives drank, all my older siblings' friends were on drugs as they were. So to me, it was just, as I've described it before, I was the Marilyn Munster of the family. You know, I was, I went against the grain, and that worked out really well for me. In the end, I don't have any. I think it worked out well.
No, I
don't miss it. Like I do, I'll have a beer. Like if I'm eating something that a beer goes with, like a steak or a pizza, I'll have a beer if it's very cold. Mm-hmm. But I don't like to get drunk. All that said, probably not normal. I'm such a control freak.
That's what I was going to get to with that, because I initially, what would happen is I'd see my friends in like grade school. You know, when they first discover you can drink, you know, grade 7, grade 8, whatever it was, and they were out of control. And I now know I have some anxiety issues and I like to control my situation. So how you hit the nail on the head there. And I think that's probably part of why we have abstained. We don't want to be out of control. We maybe have some control issues. And that's beyond me thinking maybe it was dumb. I will just say that. Like, why would you do that? Why wouldn't you want to be in the moment present? People like to escape their realities. But do you think you, it sounds like you do. You feel like you have some control issues and that's probably also why you mostly abstain?
Oh, 100%. Yeah. No, I'm like, I am riven with control issues. You know, and I think a lot of it comes from growing up in chaos, you know, from growing up in just, there was never any stability to anything. Mm-hmm. You never knew who was walking through the door. And if you knew the person, you didn't know what version of the person you were getting.
Yeah.
And I'm very much a controlling. My only phobia is elevators, because once you get in an elevator, you have no control over what happens. If it gets stuck, you will be in that elevator till someone comes and lets you out. There's no doorknob to get out. You are at the mercy of the fates.
What about airplanes? Because I just had this. Like I said, 2 14-hour travel days.
Yeah, that's a lot. For some reason, I don't have an issue with airplanes, but I do with submarines. I'm not lying.
Have you been on a submarine? Really?
Well, you'd think I was in we were in Hawaii with my family, and we were going on a submarine to look at fish with my kids, and there's a glass bottom submarine or whatever. And we're going out on the boat to meet the submarine. And I just, nope.
Yeah. Yeah. Did you panic?
I did. And yeah. I went in the submarine and I just said, this isn't for me, and left.
I'm having these experiences. So as I talk about,
I think I could do it now.
Oh, what's changed?
I don't know. I think I could breathe. I think I could breathe through it. If it has a bathroom, I'm fine. Like, I'm not afraid I'm going to get stuck in a submarine and die. I'm afraid I'm going to get stuck in the submarine and have to go to the bathroom.
I see.
And no one's okay. gonna. And everyone will look and point.
I see. So there's maybe a little bit of shame and embarrassment, because I had that too. If I think about
a little bit, I'm more shame than man.
Yeah, because that's part of it too. In grade 7, grade 8, grade 9, you'd see your friends getting hammered. It was embarrassing. I mean, that was the other. Yeah,
it's so stupid. And you grew up in Alberta, right?
No. I'm from Ontario. Canada.
Okay.
And my family and I moved. My wife's family is from here. The real estate market and job market in Ontario has been so prohibitive in the last few years. Like,
right.
we couldn't move. We got we have two kids now, my wife and I, and we had a two bedroom that
Congrats.
We started out in. Couldn't move. Bid on 12 houses. They'd say, oh, someone from Toronto's come in with an overbid by $100,000. And we'd be like, $100,000.
Yeah, and cash. Yeah,
because they sell their Toronto, shit box. And
right,
then
sure.
They have all this money because the property is more valuable than the actual structure these days. Anyway, I don't want to go on a rant. Anyway, we moved here at the very end of 2019, literally like December 28th, 2019 or something like that. Moved to a whole new place for my kids and I, at least. My wife doesn't really know. Her friends are all gone. All this to say, the pandemic came. Like, we got here and it was like minus 40 Celsius every day. And so you're like, I don't want to go outside. And then the pandemic happened. So just total lockdown and isolation. This trip I'd made to Tulsa, I went to Ontario just a couple weeks ago to visit my family and to attend a memorial service. The next week I go to Tulsa. I'm a little freaked out. I actually had to leave a concert three times because I was, the trip to Tulsa was to go to the Bob Dylan Center. I was invited to attend like some VIP grand opening thing, which was very nice. I got to see the center, and they had three concerts scheduled: Mavis Staples, Patti Smith and her band, and Elvis Costello. I get there. I was told everyone had to wear masks. No one's wearing masks. Very few of us.
Right.
And so during the Elvis Costello show, I'll tell you, panicked. I had to go outside to the smoking area three, four times. I couldn't deal. It was the last of the three shows. They don't know this, by the way. I'm not complaining. I just, that's me. I felt like I couldn't.
Was he with the imposters or was he solo?
It was with the imposters. So I had the mask on. A bunch of us did. Some of us, not a lot of us. And I couldn't, I was really packed and I felt like I couldn't breathe. And I needed to go get some air.
Yeah, my fiance, we were at Comic-Con. This is in 2019.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't know this about her. Like, she was like, I might have to leave.
Yeah.
Just because of the crush of humanity.
Yeah.
Which I don't have that I'm fine with. I don't, that I'm fine with, but I understand, like, but my stuff is equally irrational.
Yeah. 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 I
totally get it.
I know where it's coming from. And I know what I went to. I had to, when my mom's okay, but when she got sick with cancer, I had to start going to see someone to talk about, a counselor. And they explained to me, like, first of all, you can't control everything. That was basically the subtext of every session. We went through my fears and anxieties. They're like, you can control certain things. Because one of my things was I didn't like the dentist. And they're like, tell the dentist you're not happy and take a break. It's fine. You're not a helpless being, but you also can't control what happens. Your mother's going to get sick. And you're not a doctor. You can't fix that. And you're going to get sick and you can't control it. Like, so the control thing is really coming.
Yeah,
to
I had that for in 19. I started. I had that in 1992 for about 6 months. I had stage fright.
Oh, wow.
Now I've been doing. I've been performing for 10 years by that point.
Yeah.
For a living.
Yeah.
And suddenly I was like, what if I am on stage for an hour and I just don't want to be there?
yeah
it's like, and you just have to gut through it and and realize, like, I had a therapist go, like, I always say, like, what if I have to go to the bathroom? And he goes, go to the bathroom.
Yeah, exactly. the things we escalate into problems that they're like, just go get out of the dentist chair, go to the bathroom.
Yeah.
You can do that. Like, you're not some prisoner of your own
it's
whatever making.
My therapist called it catastrophizing.
Yes, or circling. I think circling, looping.
Looping is good too. Looping is good too.
You can't get out of it. Anyway, I appreciate this background, and I appreciate that we're very similar in some ways.
Yeah.
Personality-wise, because
I like to think of it as ways that make us irresistible to the ladies. We're just full of fear.
Well, but it's also like, I think some of it is rooted in, maybe it is overthinking, probably, but some of it's just rooted in common sense. Like, I think it's, I'm not judging anyone, but like, I don't see the merit in getting wasted. Like,
yeah, I don't either. Especially when you were talking about, even in Ontario, a lot of times it's the winter, it's at night.
Yeah.
And so we're going to go out into the woods and freeze and drink a cold beverage. Yes.
Yeah.
And I would just, even at the time, and I understand that this is not, I understand that I am in the far minority in this. I would be like, this is insane.
Yeah, well, socially,
this is nuts.
Socially, it's weird being in an arts and culture milieu and you don't do that stuff. Like, it can be.
Yeah.
But over time, as I established myself in various communities, it was just accepted. Like, everyone understood. And I'm happy not to do that stuff and also feel like I can leave whenever I want and not be worried about it. So, but I don't know. Did you feel like Boston in particular at that time, like you said, there people were like bartering rides for Coke, it sounds like.
I never understood. And again, like, it's so ingrained because I was raised in it. Like, that we would be in, in Boston at that point, you would do a gig in like Amherst, New Hampshire, that was an hour and a half outside of Boston. And then these guys would be desperate to get back to Boston by last call.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I was like, why do you care?
Yeah.
What? Just get in your car and go home. I was like, no, these guys needed to get to the bar before it closed.
It's an addiction. An addiction.
And they would order two drinks
because
they did not want to wait for the second.
Right. Yeah.
And it never even hit me until later. But I say that with full admission that I have a briefcase full of snakes in my head. Like, I'm full of full of neuroses.
Yeah, we all have our compulsions and addictive aspects. Like, and a lot of it's about control. Like, what you're describing about those guys, that's control. I need to get back to have a drink.
I have to get back to have a drink.
Yeah. Okay, well, I appreciate all of that. So you're in Boston. 89, you moved to L.A. In terms of comedy, it's not unusual to hear that. At some point, someone leaves whatever coast they're on and heads west.
Right.
And work beckoned. What brought you to L.A.?
Yeah, I didn't want to live in New York. I wanted to live in L.A. And I figured that it would be better to move to San Francisco. I had kind of done Boston. I'd kind of did it. And I knew I wanted to live in Los Angeles, and I knew I wasn't ready to live in Los Angeles. So I moved to San Francisco with the goal of sort of establishing a base on the West Coast of, getting gigs so I could work and make money as a comedian on the road, and then going down to L.A. and establishing a bit of a contacts in LA, but living in San Francisco so I could get stage time and work more.
Yeah.
And I will say it is one of the few instances in my life that worked exactly as planned.
Wow.
It worked exactly the way I planned it. And I was very lucky in that regard.
When I watch you do stand up, just as someone who speaks to artists, creative people, I can see the effort. Sorry, let me put it this way. I'm not saying it comes across.
Well, there's effort. There's a lot of effort.
No. What I want to say, though, is it does come across with this, like all great comedians, it comes across effortless, which of course has created this delusion among the populace that, oh, that's easy. Anyone can do that.
Sure.
That's
well put. Yeah.
What I'm saying is I can see the work you put in both in terms of the writing, but also the performative aspects. You're a very physical performer, if I might say. So out of curiosity, do you have a sense of where that comes from? Who are your people that you looked up to 100%. At that point?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, even as a kid, I was really into George Carlin.
Mm-hmm.
And then as I got older, and that was even before I wanted to be a stand-up. I just like he was so good. So, and he was ubiquitous on TV in the 70s. And he was one of the few things that, like, everyone in my family, there's three things in my family that would create silence if it was on television. A sporting event, well, four things. A sporting event, a Clint Eastwood movie, The Three Stooges, or George Carlin.
Oh, wow.
And when he was, those are like the four things that everybody was like, shut up. And so I was like, oh, I can do the last one.
Yeah, yeah.
The last guy I can do.
Yeah.
And then as I got older and wanted to be a stand-up, and, you know, I was 14 in 1978, which was the apex of Steve Martin's
yes.
explosion
yes.
and the original Saturday Night Live.
Yeah.
And those were like the Beatles and the Rolling Stones. Like, you couldn't get bigger in comedy than they were.
Yeah.
And so my appetite for comedy was sated, but I couldn't do, like, I couldn't do what Steve Martin did. Like, I didn't even realize what he was doing at the time, that he was actually doing stand-up comedy, but he was really doing a parody of stand-up comedy. Mm-hmm. It was very meta.
Yeah.
And but Carlin I could do. And then I started to watch, like, get Richard Pryor albums. And I was a big fan of Albert Brooks.
Mm-hmm.
When I got a little bit older and my tastes became a little more refined.
Yeah.
And Carlin, Pryor, Brooks, they're all very physical in their own way. I think with Albert, what I stole from Albert Brooks, Lock, Stock, and Barrel, was a controlled mania. Like, when he's talking, and he doesn't do stand up that much, but even when he's, if you watch him on Letterman or whatever show he's doing, he's so full of energy and mania, and it's controlled. And I think that that's what I have on stage, and it's not intentional. It's just my persona. I'm the same way. Like, I love going to dinner with a bunch of people and trading stories.
Yeah.
And I'm as animated as I am.
Yeah.
When I do that, it's just fun.
It's interesting just hearing that trajectory, because if I may be reductive, you've got Carlin and Pryor.
God damn it.
Sorry, I have to do it for my audience.
When you're not controlling, you're reductive.
I am. I'm a reductive controller. That's what they call me at work. No. So with Pryor and Carlin, of the people you mentioned, and this is my observation. You can correct me if I'm wrong. You know more about it than I do. Pryor and Carlin kind of start out observational, a little crowd pleasing, I would say. But then they get militant.
Yeah, they evolve. They definitely.
Yeah.
They evolve with the counterculture.
Right.
They changed with the culture in the late 60s, early 1970s.
Right. You're talking about Carlin and Pryor on Sullivan, on American talk shows, probably, is when I assume you mostly would see them on TV. Is that fair?
Yeah, you'd see them on, like, well, Pryor was harder to see.
Yeah,
I'm with Pryor. I'm more talking about right out of, like late high school.
Okay, okay.
His albums.
His albums.
And,
okay.
And we had one of the first pay services for TV.
Oh.
It was called. This is 1979, and it was called Starcase.
It was called Starcase.
Yeah.
I've never
Star
heard of that.
Starcase. That's, yeah, and it Star was a box case. On your. Okay. It was a box on your TV, and you could get, you know, the movies that they showed where it was like they showed Apocalypse Now, Serial with Martin Mull,
oh yeah,
Stardust Memories, the Woody Allen movie, Cleaned Up Dirty Movies, which is why I think my dad got it, and Richard Pryor Live in Concert. The first live in concert. So I saw Richard Pryor live in concert 100 times when I was in ninth grade. And I was like, oh, okay, that.
When I was in Ontario, I was in Ontario recently, and I stayed with my parents. And they said something about the TV that the TV wasn't working. They have some maybe illegal cable hookup. I don't want to call my parents out right now. They got something weird. It's not regular cable, but it's some. They pay a guy, and it's $15 a month. And anyway, it's like internet.
Yeah, yeah,
anyway,
yeah. Something's dodgy there.
It wasn't working at one point, and they said something that brought me back to my childhood, because my parents would refer to everything, the remote control and the cable hookup thing, the box. They would call it the box. The box isn't working. Did you?
Uh-huh.
They're from India. They never had a box. or any boxes, I don't think, before
that.
Oh,
really? Yeah.
Did you guys call it the box? I just thought that was maybe
yeah,
my culture.
Call the box.
Everyone called it the box.
Yep.
Okay.
Everyone called the box. Yep.
Anyway, okay. Sorry.
100% correct.
Bit of a tangent. So you got Carlin, Pryor. They're, I think it's fair to say, doing observational, crowd-pleasing comedy. They evolve. Then you get to Martin and Brooks, meta-comedy. Really taking the form and turning it inside out. And then we've got you. Are you some amalgam of all these sensibilities and approaches, would you say?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, like, I'm not on their level, but I definitely think that I, and again, this is really navel-gazing, and it's, you know, talking about comedy is like dissecting a frog. We're going to kill the frog, just so you know.
Yeah, I appreciate that.
But I think
that
I will, I would say that I am autobiographical in the way that Richard Pryor is autobiographical, although, you know, he's a 10 and I'm a 1 in terms of talent. But, you know, in terms of like most of my material, my best material is here's something that happened to me. I write a lot like Carlin. Like, I like to work in those sort of word games, and I'm very careful about what words I use. And I'll do, like, Carlin will write bits the way a songwriter will write a song. Like, there'll be a theme and a refrain and a the best bits.
Yeah, yeah.
And I aspire to that. I've done it. I've succeeded a couple of times. Mm-hmm. And then I think I have, from Albert, I got a sense of that controlled mania and stage presence, I guess, would be the thing.
My wife and I were watching a special of yours last night, and she just instinctively is like, he kind of reminds me of like Steve Martin. And I was like, yeah, I'm sure that's so funny. I'm sure that's in there. Just watching you, it was something about your outfit and your glasses, and I think the way you delivered jokes. I mean, there were some of them, I think she commented after a particularly harsh joke, as I recall. But I thought that was
interesting.
Well,
that could be anyone.
Yeah, exactly. Any of them. I just thought that was interesting that she picked up on that, because I picked up on it too, and you cited him just now. So I'm just saying my wife and I know what we're talking about. That's all I was getting
at. Well, I would, yeah. Okay. I think probably later Steve Martin.
Yeah.
More than the wild and crazy guy Steve Martin. Oh. I don't see the analogy, but like sort of the way that Steve Martin looks like a very normal guy, but will say things that are pretty left of field. And that's better. You know, it's like I believe it's more dangerous to look basically decent. You know, it's like 9 times out of 10, if a guy has crazy hair and a leather jacket these days, his act is probably not going to be as dangerous as his appearance.
Absolutely, yeah.
Imply.
Yes, that's fair to say. And I actually just recently rewatched Steve Martin really used SNL well after his sort of the explosion of the arena tours, and I feel like he deliberately became a movie star and calmed. I mean, that took him off the road, but he did stuff at SNL. Like, there's the bit where he his Christmas wish, I want to say. Do you know that bit where he's just like, if I had one wish, I would ask for this. And it just gets increasingly selfish and weird. And it's just that kind of like misdirection. And there's a guy in a suit just saying the most absurd things. And I think that's what my wife picked up on with you, the presentation as well. So anyway.
Oh, that's funny.
Yeah.
That's funny. I have to look that up. I think I remember it. I do think I remember it now.
No, it's a good bit. He had a lot of them. Like in the 80s when he came, 80s and 90s when he came back to SNL.
Was a medieval crossbow made of white chocolate in there?
There might be one of those. Yeah, I can't remember the litany of things. It's like, anyway, it's not necessarily worth talking about, but I if you want, I can send you the link later.
Yeah, I would like to see that. Yeah.
So, okay, we're back, and I want to take us back to LA. You say it worked out for you well when you got there around 89.
Yeah.
I think for some of us, you're known as a writer, an actor, or rather a comedian and an actor, but you write and you've written and you've executive produced.
Yeah, I'm more of a writer than an actor.
Where do you think? Where did that distinction come from? You started as a stand-up. Why did writing
I did start, and I just assumed that I was going to be a big movie star. You know, I just naturally assumed I was going to be a big star.
Yeah.
I had agents and managers tell me I was going to be a big star. So why would they be wrong? They drove BMWs.
What is your definition of a big star? For some of us, you are very successful.
I thought when I first moved here, I thought that I would be Steve Martin, I guess the equivalent would be like Will Ferrell, Jack Black. Like,
yeah, yeah.
And this was before they were famous.
Yeah.
But achieve their level. Like, I'll be in movies and TV shows and live in a big house with a pool. And then I met Ben Stiller, who was not yet famous. And I spent a couple of days with Ben because we had a mutual friend. And Janine Garofalo.
Oh, yeah.
And after hanging out with Ben for about 10 minutes, I was like, oh, shit. I can't compete with this.
Oh, he had that star power.
And his focus and his drive were so obvious. It was just like, I'm not ragging him. I'm complimenting him. You know, it was like, don't get in this guy's way. He knows what he wants. He's got his eye on the prize.
The Ben Stiller show, if I may say, I want to say came out in 92 or something like
that.
So I watched it. I don't know what was, so at 92, I'm 14, 15 years old, and that came on. It was like nothing else. I fell in love with, for those who don't know, it's Ben Stiller, Janine Garofalo, Andy Dick, Bob Odenkirk were the main cast. Right. Did you work on
David
Cross? And David Cross was
I was a writer. Yeah. I was a writer on the, I wrote on it, and David Cross came in into the season.
That's right. And it was very short. It was a one season?
And that's where David met Bob. Just one season, and that's where David met Bob.
I have the DVD set downstairs, which I think includes a lost episode or something like that.
I
believe it does. I'm fairly sure it's like the unaired episode. I don't know how.
Okay. That makes sense.
It suggests to me the show got super canceled, that they didn't even put out the...
Yes, it did. It did get super canceled. It did get super canceled. It got super canceled by a guy named Sandy Grushow, who took over Fox. And his first official act was canceling the show.
That's so horrible to me because that show was different than any other sketch show. Also a launching pad, we should say, I think, in some regards, for Judd Apatow, who is also working on the...
Oh, yeah, no, there's no in some regards, in all regards.
Yeah, he was working on the Larry... was he working on that first or the Larry Sanders Show? It was somewhere...
He was working on Stiller. He was working on Stiller first.
So really a launching pad.
I introduced Judd to Ben.
Oh.
And 6 weeks later, he was my boss.
So I appreciate that you sound like you're at peace.
But I'm glad he's done well.
It sounds like you're at peace with the fact that you have a station in life where these other dudes and people became sort of more household names. Let's keep in mind that you're at peace with this.
I have nothing to complain about.
No, you're doing well. Do you have any perspective on that, though? Like, you say Ben had the drive. Like I say, I know you from various...
I don't know. I mean, I like to think that had the career that I can handle. Hmm. You know? The example that I give is I auditioned for SNL at... in the early 90s, and it was me and two other guys, and we were flown to Chicago to audition for the show. And I went up first and had the set of my career. I mean, it was just like, as people would say, moved the building. And then the other guy went up.
People were laughing?
No, it was everything was just an 11. It was just like one of those things where just, boom, boom. I just hit it at the right time, you know?
Nice.
And then the other guy went up and he did okay. And then the third guy went up and just kind of effed around. I mean, the evening, in terms of the audience response, the evening started high and dwindled. And I walked off stage thinking, well, okay, I got SNL. This is the start of my lifelong plan. And literally thinking, so this is what it's like. This is how it feels when you are welcomed into the emperor's chambers and you become greater than normal people. And then in my neuroses, I went to control. Do I buy boxes? How do I? What do I do with my apartment? Do I get rid of my apartment? Do I sublet my apartment? What do I do with my car?
Wow.
Yeah, I went right. And this is all like that night. I'm flying back the next day with the two other comedians. And we're sitting in the three row. And I'm looking at them thinking, Adam Sandler, Chris Rock, you guys will have your opportunity. But this is all about me.
We know how that
they got it and I did. They got it and I didn't. But I think it was a year later, I had friends in the cast. Janine was in the cast.
And, oh, yeah, that's right, yeah.
And I went to visit them, and they were miserable. Like, yeah. I don't think I would have done well on that show. I'm not that kind of weirdly competitive in a weird way. And had I gotten SNL at that time, I probably wouldn't have married the girl I was dating, yeah. which I did.
Yeah.
And I wouldn't have the children that I have, which I want.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, but I was still a hot property, and I did a lot of, I had specials and albums, and I was on a lot of sitcoms and things like that.
Yeah.
You know, I'm on every sitcom in the 90s, like Roseanne, The Nanny, Seinfeld. I show up all, I have so many checks for $1.57.
Come on, is that all you got? Come on.
30-year, oh yeah, after a while, residuals go right in the
12. Oh, residuals, right. Sorry, yeah. I thought you were saying that's what they paid you to be on the show. I'm like, what?
No, at the time it was $5.27.50, I think was SAG minimum.
Oh, okay.
And then I wrote a pilot for myself to do that sold and got made. And Kevin McDonald was in it.
Oh.
Like, I was acting with Kevin McDonald.
Kids in the Hall. Yeah.
Kids in the Hall, yeah. Like, yeah. And, you know, and that to me was like, okay, I've made it. Because I was a fan of Kids in the Hall, and now I'm a peer with them.
Yeah.
I'm friends.
You know what's funny is that Thursday that I was talking about, the fateful Thursday where you and I didn't speak, also was supposed to talk to Kids in the Hall. I lost two conversations in one day. It was horrible.
There you go.
I'm supposed to talk to them as we're speaking. I'm supposed to talk to them next week.
Right.
But I feel like a horrible person because of this plane. Anyway, I love Kids in the Hall.
They don't care.
They're doing the Tonight Show. They're fine.
Kevin
might care a little bit. Yeah. Can I tell you a quick Kevin McDonald story real quick? Real quick. It's really short.
You can tell me a long one.
Kevin McDonald was doing a workshop in Guelph, like a comedy workshop thing where I lived in Guelph, Ontario. We had done a phone interview a week before, and I'd posted it as an episode of this show. And then as I was approaching the venue where he was due to perform and do some stuff, I saw him on the street, and we'd never met before. I'd only interacted with him on the phone. And he was looking at his phone, and when I approached, I said, hi, Kevin. And without looking up from his phone, he said, hi, Kevin. And it totally – I didn't know what to do. And I said, what? He's like, oh, that's just a thing I do. It's just a thing I do. And then I've told other kids in the hall, they just crack up. They think that's classic Kevin. So I just wanted to share that story because he's very, very funny.
And lovely. Lovely guy. So anyway, long story longer, I wrote a pilot and it got made and it didn't get picked up to series. But what I discovered was I actually liked writing it more than I liked acting in it. And by that time, I was about to get married, and I'd been doing stand-up for a long time already. And the idea of, you know, and this is also like comedy by now is kind of the 80s boom is dying. It's entering a fallow period. And I'd been doing it for a long time and bought a house, was getting married, and I got an offer to go work on The Simpsons. And that just became very appealing of like, hey, do you want to be a normal person? You know, you're like, you own a home, you're married, you get up in the morning, you go to work, your work is fun. And then you come home at night and you have dinner with your wife and you watch TV and you go to bed. And that was really appealing to me.
Yeah.
And I really enjoyed it.
Can you
really enjoyed it?
Given what you do though, like you're describing a really optimal 9-to-5 situation.
Oh, sure. I'm not unaware of that.
But are you?
I wasn't going to work in a foundry. I mean,
No. But I mean, you know what? As we're speaking, and it's sort of because of the pandemic, it's shifted things around. We were seeing a lot more movie stars doing TV shows and saying, "This is amazing. Uh-huh. I go to
yeah, and you'll see more of it now that movies are sort of going away.
Yeah, yeah. So I'm just saying, but I think when you talk to them, when a person gets to the age where they have a family, it's just like, this is insane. You want me to go to Australia to shoot a movie for 6 months? Like, I don't want to do that anymore.
Yeah.
So I think,
as you know this too, you know, the best thing about kids is it's sort of narcissistic and it's anti-narcissism, is that the one of the great things about kids is it's not about me anymore.
Yeah.
And I found that a tremendous relief.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah.
No, I agree. And I love,
if they're happy, healthy, well fed and educated, I'm a success.
It's that sentiment has been heightened in recent years, I will say that. And having moved them, because my wife will sometimes be like, I don't know, they seem like upset. I'm like, we moved them across the country, away from their friends. Now there's a pandemic. Like, there's a lot going on in their little, I think all of us are, I don't know about you, and I don't want to speak on your behalf, but there's like I've described it as like low level stress every day since this. If it's not heightened by like me having to flee an Elvis Costello show, it's just low. It's just always there, you know?
Yeah, it's always there. It's always humming underneath.
Yeah. So you get into The Simpsons. This is a huge deal for you, I'm guessing. So 9 to 5, where I was coming from with that 9 to 5 business is, as a creative person, as a comedian, can you turn your brain off? Like, can you stop at 5 and stop thinking of funny things?
No. Yeah, I mean, I'm a workaholic. While I was on the, I did do The Simpsons, but I still did stand up. I didn't stop doing stand up. I couldn't go on the road, but I did shows in LA all the time.
Yeah.
And I wrote 4 movies, I think, during my time at The Simpsons. Like, I made a short movie. You know, the thing that I did realize after I had been there a while was that I was still a bigger fan of me than I was of the show. Mm. And, you know, that eventually led to me leaving the show after, 7 years. I was really like, I have done this.
7 years. And, so what year did you leave again?
2000 to 2007, 8.
7, 8, right, yeah, okay, yeah. Right. And that's a symptom or a signal or something. I don't know what it is. It's an aspect of being a self-propelling force. When you're a comedian, you're really autonomous. And so when you...
Yeah.
I'm sure you've had this. As soon as you get into, like, even shooting scenes on a sitcom, you start to feel like, oh, I'm in a parameter-based situation here, and I'm used to just doing whatever I want. You did a job for 7 years and probably felt a little of that bristling, like...
I felt like I was kind of making tires. I was just like, okay, I know how to... we've done this. Yeah. But that said, I mean, it was a great job, and I learned how to write there. I worked in a room every day with the best writers I'll ever meet, and the funniest people I've ever met. You know, like, I know a lot of famous comedians. I don't know anybody funnier than George Meyer.
Right.
You know, and George Meyer can walk down, it looks like any guy you see at the hardware store. But, like, I've never, like, I'm in awe of, like, people like George Meyer, Mike Scully, John Schwartzwelder. I'm just in awe of them. And I realized it was great. It was like, you know, famous doesn't mean funniest.
Yeah.
And fame is ridiculous. If you, you know, it's just like, if you can do what you want to do, you win.
Yeah.
You know, like, I have this stupid show on YouTube called Hanging with Dr. Z that I think is the best thing I've ever done. And, the fact that that my work has allowed me to do that is, to me, is a success. And I, you know, it's like, you know, so I'm every bit as fulfilled by doing that as by being in, you know, as I would have by being in Jumanji or, you know, whatever.
You know. You're still going for roles and stuff? You still do that stuff?
I don't go for them, but I'm doing a movie. Like, I do little, like, I'm doing a movie that a friend of mine is doing, like, who's in a punk band, and they're making a movie. It's sort of like the punk rock Magical Mystery Tour, and you know, it's got guys from the Circle Jerks in it.
Oh, nice.
My friend Rob Zabrecki, who was a lead singer of Possum Dixon, and you know, a lot of people, and I'm like, you know, I'm doing that, and I'm writing on a TV show now, and writing a feature, and doing Dr. Z, like, and have a podcast and everything. Like, I'm super, 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 super busy.
Yeah.
But no, I never became as famous as like Ben or Chris or Adam, but I can't complain.
No, I don't think you can. I'm telling you right now, you can't complain. We think some of us think you're doing quite well for yourself with your.
Yeah, yeah, that's and it's all. You know, I would rather be somebody that always was like at a 4,
yeah,
than somebody that was at a 10 and is now at a 4.
Yeah,
what happened to you?
Yeah, what do you make of the evolution of the Simpsons situation that has occurred? They've shifted. I think you know what I'm talking about. There was a lot of controversy about who was voicing who and representation. They seem to have listened after some. Yeah. Time of not listening. I don't know if you're still in touch with people there. It's been a long time since you've been involved in any.
Yeah, I have. Yeah, I am. Yeah, it's like the mafia. You're always
there. What do you make of how they've finally, I guess, I don't mean to put, no, I'll say finally responded. Yeah.
I wasn't there when it went through that growth. Growth is painful. Talk to a 13-year-old. And ugly and sometimes necessary. And I think it's fine. I mean, the only thing that I can say is there was never an ill intention to anything.
Yeah.
It was sort of frozen in amber from 1990, like when it started on the Tracy Ullman show.
Yeah.
And it, you know, for a long time it was the gold standard. So yeah, it's not surprising that it would become a little isolated and insulated.
Yeah.
And then it had to catch up. And a lot of times you don't know you're doing the wrong thing. And your instinct is to say, no, I'm not. Because if I'm not a hateful person, how can you accuse me of doing a hateful thing?
Well,
and it takes, you get to step back and acknowledge that you don't know what you don't know.
I grew up loving The Simpsons, and it wasn't until I got into maybe university or college, as you Americans call it. No, you call them universities too. Mm-hmm. I got into university, and I gained a greater appreciation and perspective about my difference. Mm-hmm. It happened. My thing was like growing up in grade school, I would undercut the racism by doing it to myself and using the words against myself, mm-hmm. Not really realizing what I was doing. You know, it's the equivalent of people reclaiming negative terminology. And sure. I did it. I did it, and it made the white kids laugh.
Right.
And they couldn't do it. I didn't know what I was doing.
Right.
But I will say, you know what I'm getting at?
I do. And I'll say this. I learned that kids of East Asian descent and Indian descent and Palestinian descent were called Apu as a derogatory.
Yeah.
Had we known that at the time, we would have dropped that character like a bad habit.
Yeah.
It never entered anyone's mind, which is not to say we didn't care. It's to say it never entered anyone's mind.
And what I was going to say is it didn't bother me as I was really engrossed in the show.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, I don't think there was anything explicit, but my parents were if I told my parents, particularly at university age, that my roommates were very excited that I brought Indian food back with me the last time I came home from my mother and my father, they'd say, "What? The Canadian kids like the Indian food?"
Yeah,
and
sure,
so
yeah.
There any representation, so they were aware of The Simpsons, they were aware of Apu, they were aware of references to Ganesh and Hinduism, and that was them. So I think on some level, they didn't view it, and I didn't view it, as disparaging or problematic. It was like, oh, someone for my family, it wasn't me, I don't think, but my parents probably thought, oh, someone's talking about our culture. They didn't even recognize
it.
I
think it's mixed, you know, because there were respectful, you know, we did, you know, The Simpsons is also one of the only families on television that goes to church regularly. I mean, it's a mixed bag. I think people want to see, people see what they want to see. But, you know, it's hard in terms of like, in terms of the sort of cultural revolution that we've gone over in the past 10 years. And like anything, the pendulum swings really far and then it kind of resettles. It goes to an extreme and then it resettles. And it's hard, but you don't want to be the guy complaining about, you know, I hear white male comedians complaining about wokeism.
Yeah.
And what I see in my mind is Bob Hope and Jack Benny making fun of the Beatles.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, you don't want to be that guy.
Yeah.
And, you know, at a certain point, after 35, 40 years old, culture isn't pointed at you anymore.
That's right.
It's pointed at the younger people.
Right.
And it's your, and, you know, there's a great quote, John Entwistle, the bassist for The Who, was complaining that he didn't understand rap music. And Pete Townsend said, it's not our job to understand it. It's our job to get the fuck out of the way.
Yeah.
And he's right. You know, that's, you know, if you don't like, you know, not being able to, you know, affect an effeminate voice or a black voice anymore, tough.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
Things are different now. If evolution doesn't favor the strongest, it favors that which is the most adaptable to change.
Yes.
And you have to change and grow where you go.
That's,
you
know, that's very well put, Dan, and I appreciate that perspective.
I say that as somebody who, like, if you saw the special I saw, you saw, like, there's stuff on that, to use the sweaty old expression, I could not do today.
Said that exact thing to my wife today.
Yeah.
Said that exact thing about the special we watched.
I know what's wrong.
And it's the one. Yeah. It's the one.
And the last 15 minutes of that is not cool.
Probably not, but.
Probably not. No, there's no probably.
Right. So, but that's the way the world is. Like, you can't, on some level, you can measure those things up against the past. You can measure some things from the past.
Groucho Marx sang like Paul Robeson.
Yes.
Duck Soup.
There's a lot of problems that we don't really realize are problems till, like I said, I didn't realize till university in some ways what I was doing as a kid was wrong, because those jokes in a more enlightened atmosphere, the self-effacing jokes, they're like, we don't need to hear those words. And I was like, I don't even like saying those words anymore. I'm gonna stop as well. And so that's
things change. James Bond doesn't rape women anymore.
Exactly.
You know, things change.
Things change. We become enlightened and things change and we all, I appreciate that. Now, you are doing these, a show or shows in Vancouver.
I'm doing a show on, May 27th
or 8th or something like that.
At the Rio Theater. Yeah.
I'm sure.
Yeah.
I'll include all that, info in the, podcast description so people can get tickets.
You can bring your children, but they will leave profoundly damaged. May 28th at the Rio Theater.
Right. So my question is, obviously we don't want to spoil your set, but your country in particular is very fraught. You know what? Your country is always very fraught, socioculturally,
politically. We're told that we're God's favorite country. You'd think things would be a lot more peachy.
I see from your social media feeds that you are a very outspoken and wise observer of what's happening or what has been happening.
Yeah.
How much? But I know as a comedian, you want to entertain people. How much of what's
my act is not about that. My act is pretty inclusive, and I try to do, again, to borrow from Carlin, I try to step back and take the meta view. And, you know, no one is going to leave alienated or attacked. It's mostly self-referential, but there's also a way that you can make your point, which I do, in a way it's not personal.
Yeah.
It's in terms of like socio-political differences. And I know it's probably the same in Canada. It's acute in America. We've gone from I'm right and you're wrong to I'm right and you're evil.
Yeah.
And because there are people that make money off that.
Yeah.
The people that make the most money off it don't even believe what they're saying.
Yeah.
That's just what they do for a living.
Yeah.
And I'm not a fan of nihilism in any stripe.
Yeah.
You know, it's all going to burn. Okay. Okay, person without kids.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. And I'll give you an example of something that I say that's like, here's something that's probably not correct. But, you know, having dinner with a bunch of people, and my oldest daughter is in college right now. She just started she's a freshman. And somebody said, so what is your daughter studying? I said, well, we're very, very proud of her. She worked really hard, and she studied, and really is really dedicated, and she's majoring in becoming a stripper. We're very, very happy. And somebody at the table went, but if that's what she wanted to do, that would be okay. And I was like, nope. It wouldn't be. I want sex workers to have insurance and a union and all the safety in the world. But if you want to tell me that being a lawyer or a doctor is the same as giving hand jobs behind the Goodwill, I'm going to say you're full of shit.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a fair assessment, Dana. I think that's not that controversial to me. But
you would be surprised. Yeah. But you would be surprised. Yeah. You would be surprised.
It is a weird,
you know, at a certain point you're just nuts.
Yeah, it's a strange terrain in that regard. I have children. I want the best for them, but yeah. There is this constant moving of the goalpost in terms of what being the best is and what, you know. Yeah. So, yeah.
What if it's what they want? She also wanted to eat crayons. I wasn't a big fan of that either.
Okay, so it is in the realm of personal observational kind of comedy. You're not getting too deep into
absolutely,
that. Okay.
Yeah.
Now,
no, it's not. It's not that. Yeah.
So how long, as I recall, when
it's about somebody who's in the world.
Right.
So.
Right.
Can't avoid it.
I remember, I want to say it was 4 or 5 years ago. You had a release on Kill Rockstars, Mr. Funny Man. Is that what it was?
Mr. Funny Man. Yeah. Yeah.
How many have you had specials since then?
Yes. Earlier this year, I had a documentary and a film come out called Joyride, which mm-hmm. is currently streaming. It's and the audio and the album of it comes out in next month.
Oh.
And what Joyride was Bobcat Goldthwait and I started to do this thing.
Yes.
Where we started to go on the road together. And we figured, like, if we go on the road together, we can sell out a large venue, like a 300, 400 seater, and we only have to do one night, and then we go to the next town. And we would flip a coin to see who would go on first and who would go on second. And we would go out and F around for a couple of minutes, flip a coin, and then somebody would leave and somebody would stay. Mm-hmm. And what we found was people really liked it when we were on stage together. And so one night we just said, let's just see how long we can stay on stage together. And we were on there for like 2.5 hours.
Oh, wow.
And it flew by.
Yeah.
And we both did our act, but we did it concurrently. Like I would literally, like, we would be talking and something, and that would trigger something in Bob. I knew his inventory. He knew my inventory. And he would step forward and I would step back. And then we would go back and forth in tandem.
Nice.
Yeah, we didn't have two-man bits. We would just kind of do it in tandem.
Yeah.
It was great. And we did a tour and then filmed it. And then we were going to release it as a concert, you know, special. And COVID happened.
Ah.
And so suddenly Bob had all of this time. This free time. So what he did was he built a documentary about our relationship, because although we are best friends today, we used to hate each other.
Mm.
Hate each other. So,
like, not like not you didn't have like a Seinfeld level of hate for Bob, did you?
No, well, no one could.
Sorry, everyone. This is just common knowledge that for some reason something happened there, and Jerry.
It's addressed in the documentary.
Oh, okay.
It's addressed. As Bobcat says, Jerry Seinfeld finally has an opinion, and it's about me. But what happened was Bob lived in Boston with a group of comedians that were our mutual friends. And then he moved to San Francisco. And then I moved into Boston and I sort of took his place. And so when he came back, I was like the new guy. I was like dad's new wife. And, you know, it just got off on a bad foot and stayed there for 15 years. But no, we're creepily identical in terms of the stuff that we like and we are adults now, grown men, and he's one of my best friends. So he did the documentary that not only deals with our relationship with each other, but our relationship with comedy. Huh. And it's not how we became comedians, but why we became comedians. And there's a lot of footage of our early careers and our early childhoods. And interspersed with that is us on stage.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, you can see it on iTunes. It's called Joyride.
So wait, it is out now then? People can watch it?
It's out now. Okay. Yeah, it's, you can watch it tonight. that's a lot of me. That's a lot of me for you to have to watch.
I was sent a...
And the album comes out next month.
The album comes out next month.
On 800 Pound Gorilla.
So the album will be a distillation of the stand-up stuff you guys did together. Okay, yeah. I was sent a press release about this film, and I did reach out. I must have been pre-COVID or whatever it was. And I did reach out to be like, oh, I'd love to talk to Bob and Dana. So I'm glad.
I apologize for them not calling you back.
No, it's fine.
Heads are going
to
roll.
People are busy. I'm sure I'd like to catch up with Bobcat at some point, and maybe we will someday.
He's doing great.
Yeah,
he's
good, doing great. Good. Well, so that's amazing. If people want to learn more about you and your work that we've talked about and your upcoming tour dates and all those sorts of things, Dana, where would you like to send them?
Go to danagould.com.
Okay.
It's all there. You can go to my tour dates. You can go to my podcast. You can go to Hanging with Dr. Z. And you can go to my weekly, I have a weekly sort of newsletter called The Cinemorph, which is just my area of interest, which is just weird Hollywood crap not from today, from the 20s to the 70s.
Oh.
Or even into the 80s. But, you know, it's just, you know, it'll get you through a visit to the bathroom.
You have some very fascinating conversations in your podcast about things like stunt people. Just like that's just fascinating. Like
I'm interested in stuff. Yeah.
No, it's great.
Yeah.
Okay, and then you're on all socials and stuff like that.
I'm all that crap. Although my favorite is Instagram.
You like Instagram the best. I keep hearing that. Yeah. People are less enamored of Twitter, and they like Instagram now for some reason.
Well, you know, here's an example of the kind of stuff you'll hear on stage. you know, just go on Twitter tomorrow morning and just post quietly, I like French toast. And just check back in 20 minutes. Like, fuck French toast. Yes, your majesty. It's like, it's so, all right, come on.
People are very angry about everything, and they have so many platforms to express it now. Maybe has contributed to the deterioration of decorum and civility in our society.
A lot of Twitter used to be done by people walking down the median of the interstate pushing a grocery cart.
Well,
and no one back then said, let's pull over and hear what they have to say.
It's true. We do hear from these people. I have this at one of my jobs. They want to send me all the feedback every day. I'm like, why? Yeah. Why do we need to hear from all the comments? Who cares? Anyway.
Exactly.
All right.
Exactly.
So
why do you think I care?
Why are we caring about this? Anyway. Okay. DanaGould.com. Dana, thank you so much for spending any time with me at all. I really, really...
Oh, my pleasure. No, it was great. I really enjoyed the conversation.
I appreciated it too, and I wish you the best of luck in the future.
Super cool.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Well, that was a lot of fun. Thank you very much to Dana Gould for appearing on this the 689th episode of Creative Control, which is part of the Entertainment One podcast network and is available wherever you get your podcasts. If you can't find an episode that you've heard about and you're looking for it, or if you want to learn more about me and sign up for my monthly newsletter, please visit my website, vishkana.com. You can also like Creative Control on Facebook or follow the show on Twitter at Vish Creative, or you can follow me directly on Twitter and on Instagram at Vish Khanna. Also, please visit patreon.com/creativecontrol to make a flexible monthly donation to sustain this podcast right away. A big thank you to everyone who supports the show on Patreon. That is the primary source of revenue, really the only substantial source of revenue for this show. Otherwise, I'm just doing this for free, and that sometimes gets to me. So I appreciate all the support, financial the financial support I meant to say there. $6 or more a month grants you access to exclusive content. That can include, overtime with current guests. Sometimes I also dig into my past archive of old interviews, and I post things up there when they seem relevant, you know. So go to patreon.com/creativecontrol to support the show however you can. Also, if you're interested in receiving a Creative Control t-shirt, just message me on Patreon and I'll get you one while supplies last. Thanks again to Pizza Trocadero, The Bookshelf, and Planet Bean Coffee in Guelph, and Granddad's Donuts in Hamilton for their in-kind support for this show. Thanks as always to my friend Jim Guthrie. He lets me use some music of his on the show, and you can learn more about Jim at his website, jimguthrie.org. He's always up to something. Not schemes, just music, usually. Maybe there's some scheming. I shouldn't have said that, maybe. Also, thank you. Finally, you. Thank you so much for listening to this episode with Dana Gould. I hope you enjoyed it, and we'll check out Dana's work. I also hope you'll consider subscribing to or following this podcast, however you access podcasts, and I hope you'll tell your friends about the show. So help spread the word about it. That's really how it gets around. That means a lot. Anyway, thank you so much for everything you do. I hope you stay safe and sane and this somewhat unsafe and weird world, and I will talk to you very soon. Bye for now.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to Quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.